Welcome to the third edition of the Farland Author Advisory Conference Calls. These calls are sponsored by David Farland's Writers Groups. That's at www.farlandswritersgroups.com, a free writers group forum for aspiring writers. My name is Robin Weeks. I'll be your host for the call tonight. Today is November 30th, 2010. David Farland himself is with us again tonight. David, welcome.
Well, thank you.
We've been listening to David tell us about some of the stories that he's written and some of the genres that he's written in. David, of course, is also known as David Wolverton in the sci-fi world. He's best-selling author of science fiction and fantasy. He's served for many years as the coordinating judge for the Writers of the Future contest. He's been a creative writing instructor at BYU, at Brigham Young University. That's my alma mater, great college. He's an instructor. He's trained many authors who have gone on to become New York Times bestsellers themselves, including Stephanie Meyer, Brandon Sanderson, Brandon Mull, Eric Flint, Sean Williams, and many others, which is an amazing accomplishment. He has written and edited 50 published books, including novels for adults, young adults, anthologies, middle grade readers, picture books. So he is sublimely qualified to tell us how to write a story, which coincidentally is topic of our call tonight. David, what are the basic elements of a good story?
Well, you know, that's often a long debate, but I'm not going to go into the history of it. I sort of like to take Algis Budges' basic definition of what a story is, and if you look online, I suspect you could probably find a copy of that article. It's also available in some of the old Writers of the Future anthologies. But Algis points out that a story is more than just any piece of prose that happens to be thrown on paper. You know, you can write a great description, you can write a little character summary or something like that. And there are people in the literary world who would say whatever you write and call a story, that's a story. Might not be a very good story. A story typically does something. It has emotional movement. It gives us, it teaches us things. It draws the reader in and forces us to sort of suspend our disbelief and for a little while get caught up in an artificial world that's just created in our mind with the words on paper. And so there's a lot that a story does, and I don't want to get into the depths of all of this, but I have thought that, you know, when I'm writing my little Daily Kick articles, I try to take a couple of pages and just give a tip each day. And the problem with that is that it gives you, it's kind of scattershot. It's like shooting a barn, the side of a barn with a shotgun, and you know, you got a pellet here and a pellet there. And so I wanted to try to pull a lot of what I'm saying into a little bit of a cohesive form for you, I guess is what it comes down to. So here's the parts of the story that Algis Budges used to say that there were. He said that the story had three parts. The first part was a character in a setting with a conflict. Okay, so that was the first three parts of a story. And as we conflict becomes a little bit, as the conflict is introduced, we have a try-fail cycle, an attempt to resolve the conflict, along with a second try-fail cycle. And both of those, there's some sort of failure involved, although there may be some near success. Then finally we have the third try-fail cycle, in which the character ultimately succeeds or fails, depending upon what kind of story you're telling. And we have the denouement, the ending. So he would say that there were seven parts of a story. I think that, you know, it's helpful to think about, you know, beginnings and middles and ends of a story. And there's a number of different ways to look at stories, whether you're looking at them, you know, as story shapes, or if we start looking at them on a graph chart where we see a triangle, the Fourault's triangle, that says a common tool that's used by writers to diagram what a story looks like. Uh-huh. But I wanted to talk about them, you know, in various parts. And so let's kind of go through, and I'm going to take Algis Budras's definition. I'm going to modify it a little bit. I like to think of my characters, and I'm going to say there's 8 or 9 points to a story rather than his 7. And the reason why is that as I try to think about stories and how I'm going to write a story, I look at the little pieces that I break my stories down into, and I tend to break them down into 9 pieces. So my first part in the opening of the story, I typically have to deal with a character. Now, okay. My character, my protagonist, may be male, female, old, young. The age and the sex of the protagonist will depend upon the audience I'm trying to attract. If I want to attract children, I'm going to write a book with children protagonists, most likely. If I want to attract adult females from writing a romance, then I would write, I would have a protagonist who's an adult female. And it's very important to understand that we tend to read stories or prefer reading stories about people that we can understand and empathize with, and we understand and empathize best with people who are like us, both in sex and age and a lot of other things. You know, we can get down to the levels of politics and economics and where they're raised and all that kind of thing. In any case, you need to introduce your character, and you need to think deeply about what kind of character you're creating in order to satisfy the audience that you're going to be writing to. And the second thing you have to do is to create, and when you talk about creating a character, I guess I want to go into this just a little bit more. You can create a character and you can give them physical attributes, but those are kind of unimportant. You know, whether your character has red hair or brown hair or black hair doesn't matter a whole much, a whole bunch. We have to get into describing the interior of the character. You know, we describe how they think, what they like, what they're afraid of, what's their biggest fear, what things are they ashamed of that they've done. You know, what is their past? Who do they love? Who do they care about? You know, with all sorts of things that are far more important. For example, we tend to, one signal that a character is a likable person is if that character has friends or if he has someone who loves him or her, you know. So we need to sit down and think about associations that your character has. So when you create a character, you're not just creating one character. You very often have to create a web of characters. You know, when you're dealing with your protagonist, I might go, I've got my 15 girlfriends, I've got my dog, you know, all of those kinds of things.
Is there one thing that new writers generally skip when they're writing about a character, when they're trying to build a character? What's the most common mistake you see?
Well, the most common mistake that I see when people are trying to write new characters is that they don't take time to, how should I say this? They tend to make them one-dimensional. They've got one problem, one way of looking at the world. They don't have much interior conflict. And so that's part of developing your character is finding the things that they're conflicted about.
Okay.
You know, all of us have interior conflicts. And you have to start saying, okay, well, I really strongly believe in religious freedom. On the other hand, I don't want those kooks in that cult, you know, with their 15 wives, you know, living next door, you know. You might have those types of things. So, you know, each one of us has those interior conflicts. And so that's probably the most common thing for young writers is that they try to make the person too black and white.
And you said that, you know, that you've got setting characters and conflicts that you have to establish when you're writing a story. Is there a certain order we should set them up? I mean, do we get the character first, then build the setting and the conflicts around them? Can we start in the opposite direction?
So much depends upon what kind of story you're telling. You know, if you're setting, how should I say this? Generally speaking, I would start with my setting. And the reason for that is that the characters have to grow out of your setting. So if I set a story in France in in 1708, there's a certain kind of limitation to what my character can know, what kind of schools they may have gone to, what types of job my character may have, those types of things. You know, what are the social conventions of the time? If I set my story on the planet Dune, 4,000 years in the future, you know, once again, I've got my own, you know, little set of problems and concerns for my character. You know, he's got to deal
Worry about the polygamist.
Yeah, he's got to worry about the Freeman and the sandworms and the storms and whether or not the neighboring planets are going to drop nukes on you and, you know, those types of things. So your character grows out of your setting, okay? And then the next step is you've got to come up with a conflict. And your conflict grows out of your character. In other words, for me, having, you know, strange neighbors in a cult with multiple wives living next door might be a problem. For somebody else, you know, it might seem like nothing, you know, that's not a conflict at all. Nice folks, there's always somebody to babysit my kids if I need them, you know, that kind of thing. So the conflicts that you have, the things that bother you that that really, you know, turn a character on or off or antagonize them, the things they're willing to go over to war over, varies from person to person. You know, one person might decide that I can no longer tolerate these English kings, and it's time to start a revolutionary war here in Americas. And the guy living next door is like, you know, that's treason that you're talking about. You know, yes, they may be a little bit hard on us, but you've got to see it from King George's side of the fence. So the character is really what gives rise to the conflict. And
okay.
So you have to sort of approach them in the order of setting, create your characters, and then create your conflicts.
Okay. Well, once you've got that, I guess there's, you said there's an inciting incident next.
Yes, that's right. The next thing that I go for is my inciting incident. Now, you have to understand that when you're writing a short story, when an editor looks at you have a certain number of pages that you can get to before the editor is going to say, if I don't have all of my pieces, those first three pieces to my story, I'm going to set this aside. And so normally with Writers of the Future, I gave you two pages. If you didn't have it in two pages, you darn well better have something that really entices me to keep reading, because I would probably set you down. I've known editors.
That's actually a long time. Two pages is a lot longer than some people will read, right?
Yeah, well, two pages is a long time. I was generous because I was working with Writers of the Future. But I know magazine editors who say, I want to see all of that within the first page or something like that, you know. So each editor has their own little limits. But you want to make sure that you get that kind of information together quickly, which means that you don't have time to sit down and do a long character sketch. You don't have time to sit down and say, do a page and a half of setting up the scene, talking about the scenery, which a lot
of... And Bob was born at a very early age.
Yeah, exactly. Or going back into ancient history or something like that. Those are the kinds of things that new authors do when they're trying to figure out how to approach the story. Let me say, there's one more thing that Algis Budrys didn't talk about, because he talked about the character and the setting. I also talk about your treatment of the story, okay? And by that I mean the tone of voice that you use, the character voices that you create, maybe the use of irony, or you might decide that you want to have a very florid style and a very lyrical style, and so you'll choose the style that you're going to use as you work on that piece. And I think that's a conscious decision that you have to make fairly early on, too. In any case, you have to write that story. You have to have a promising start. And by that I mean your opening is going to promise what kind of story this is going to be. So, for example, if you open with a lot of jokes, it might promise that this is going to be a humorous story. Or if you open with a character who's looking for love, then you're promising a romance, you know, that type of thing. That's an important aspect of it. So anyway, we get up to the inciting incident. At some point, your character is going to discover that his or her life has changed, that they're up against a problem that's much larger than anything that they imagined. And that problem typically is going to destroy that character's life unless it's resolved. And so that's the inciting incident. An inciting incident can happen early on in the story. It can happen on the first paragraph, as it did in, for example, in Brandon Sanderson's Elantris. Or you can have an inciting incident that is way, way off into the middle of the story. If you look at Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, for example, we have a story about a woman who's, you know, thinking about robbing a bank. She robs the bank. She gets away with it. She flees off, drives for hours, gets to a motel, takes a shower, and while she's taking a shower, she gets stabbed. And you're wondering that whole time, well, gosh, what do we think about this woman? Is she a good protagonist? Is she going to change her mind? Why should I like her? You know, all these kinds of questions. And it's not until we're, gosh, I don't know, 20 minutes into the story or something that we have a detective who goes looking for her at this hotel and starts finding clues that lead him to stay and really examine, you know, what's going on better. So here we have an inciting incident that was way, way deep into the story. So deeply into the story that, you know, a lot of modern filmmakers will say you could never make that movie nowadays. But the truth is you couldn't make the movie back when Alfred Hitchcock did it. The only reason he was able to do it was because he was already considered a master, and he demanded to make it. And
Alfred Hitchcock. You would say putting the inciting incident earlier.
That's right, exactly. So basically, you start your inciting incident, and that typically happens within the first one-tenth of a story. That means if you've got a 90-minute movie, you're going to make it within the first 8 or 9 minutes. If you've got a book that's 200 pages long, then it's going to happen in the first 20 pages. Or if it's 400 pages long, it'll happen in the first 40 pages. And readers will give you that long before they decide whether or not they want to set the book down. So they're looking for that inciting incident that's going to hook them into the whole story. Okay? So that's the next part of the story that I like to put in that Algis Budrys didn't put in, which was the inciting incident.
Okay.
Once you have an inciting incident, every story has what we call the first try-fail cycle. And I've come up with other ways to try to describe what a try-fail cycle is. But a try-fail cycle is where the character recognizes that he has a problem and he tries to do something to resolve that problem, okay? So let's say that a king discovers that an enemy nation has an army on its borders, okay? Normally, the first thing that he's going to try is diplomacy. And he'll send maybe his son or a duke or some other high official out to point out to them, hey, you've got an army on our borders, okay? Diplomacy almost always fails, okay? So the duke or the son or whoever usually ends up getting their head chopped off and, you know, tossed over the castle walls in a catapult as a sort of way of saying, we're not here to talk, okay? And so if you watch that, you'll see that as a very common cycle or a very common first try-fail cycle in almost all movies and television shows and books that you're going to read. People will try to talk about a problem. Once talking fails, and of course there's different types of try-fail cycles. Sometimes you'll have a try-fail cycle where and particularly if you've got a story about a heroic character, you may have a character who seems to get what he wants, okay? And at the last gasp, it's taken from him. So, for example, if you watch you know, the first Indiana Jones movie, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Indiana Jones starts out, he goes into a cave. All of the people around him are terrified. All of the Indians are afraid to go in. So, you know, he sort of says, oh, come on, guys, let's go. And he creeps into the cave, and there's big spider webs and a bunch of tarantulas, you know, fall on his back, and he sweeps them off with his hand, and he gets deeper into the cave, and arrows start shooting out of walls, and so he, you know, goes running across this little narrow passage as the arrows shoot behind him, and he goes in and finds a golden relic sitting, you know, on top of this little table, and he puts a bag of sand there to try to gauge how much it's going to weigh, and then he quickly flips them, you know, he gets his golden relic and comes all of a sudden, finds out that the entire room is booby-trapped, and the relic's band starts sinking into the ground, and a great big boulder comes rolling down and chases him, and he leaps across a pit and barely escapes with his life, and as he's getting out of the cave with the golden statue in his hand, he trips at the very entrance and falls down, and suddenly there's an old enemy with a bunch of Indians that have blow darts aimed at him and say, you know, thank you, Mr. Jones, for delivering this to us, and he takes it and goes. So that was a try-fail cycle that appeared to succeed until the very end, when suddenly there's a reversal, and the item was taken from Indiana Jones. You know, the treasure's taken from him. And so we see that a lot with heroic stories. The heroic character in the beginning seems to get what he wants, or even maybe fights to a standstill. If you look at the last movie for Star Trek, for example, it opens with Captain James T. Kirk's father as second in command on a starship, and they are confronted by an alien ship, and the alien aboard the ship asks the captain of the ship of the Farragut to go aboard the ship, and the guy goes thinking he's going to negotiate some sort of a peaceful solution to the problem. And, of course, Nero gets the guy in there, asks him what year it is, asks him if he knows where Spock is, and then gets angry when the guy can't produce Spock for him, and so he goes and kills him. So once again, we see that the talking phase, the opportunity to sit down and negotiate never really works here very well. And so suddenly James Kirk's father is put in the position where he's running the ship, and he's trying to lay down cover fire while the people on his ship evacuate. And so he does. He lays down cover fire and manages to hold off Nero's ship so that 800 crew members can escape, which includes his wife and who's delivering a child right at that time. And so in ancient Greek fashion, we see that we have a hero. This man gives his life to fight off Nero. And that, of course, he has a son who also is a person of heroic proportion, as we learn throughout the rest of the tale.
Are there any tricks that you can tell us about how to make a twist sound unexpected? Because, you know, as you said, you know, this happens since Greek times. You know, diplomacy doesn't work. Is there a way to make it sound, whoa, I didn't see that coming?
Well, there's a couple of things to do. One thing is, first of all, pick twists that really just, you know, don't appear, you know, first. They're not the first thing that pops in your mind. And by that I mean a lot of times some authors will go in and actually try to paint themselves into a corner or write themselves into a corner where they just don't see any way for their hero to succeed. And then they figure out what your hero does, okay? That's not really a thing that I'd recommend. But one thing you can do is to create a false trail where you give hints that your character is planning one thing and maybe actually is planning one thing. But when he sees that it won't succeed, all of a sudden he might have to take a different tact. And so, you know, basically try to lay down a false trail lead up to one potential climax and then show us another. So, for example, very often when a writer has a character who may be going into battle and, you know, is going to be facing his own death, you know, he'll talk about how he accepts death and, you know, he has this moment of where he reaches some clarity and prepares himself mentally for battle and sort of says goodbye to everybody and you know, gives us a lot of foreshadowing that shows that this character is going to die. And then, of course, as the character gets into battle, he finds some way to come home alive. You know, so basically that type of thing. The other trick that I would suggest is that, let's say you want to twist something. Think of the emotional opposite of what you're trying to accomplish. For example, Tolkien, before he would, you know, he would go along and he would describe things that were sort of boring. You know, he'd talk about the woods and the birds twittering and the weather. And just when you were getting your eyes starting to gloss over, you know, in the distance, the hobbits would hear the singing of elves, you know, and they go, elves, elves, you know. So having something boring before something that's interesting, having a moment of laughter before a moment of terror. In the movie Jaws, there's this one instance where we have, I guess, James Caan as the actor is throwing... I hope that I got the name right. Can't remember for sure. But anyway, he's throwing meat off the back of a boat, and he tells a joke, and everybody in the audience is laughing. And just as they're laughing, a big piece of meat goes over the back, and the great white shark rears up and grabs it, you know, practically takes his arm off at that moment. And so the laughter turns into a scream, okay?
Uh-huh.
That's an emotional twist, humor to horror. But you can do horror to wonder, for example. You could set us up with some creepy music, you know, as some kid is getting ready to open Pandora's box, and when he opens the box, all of a sudden we see, you know, scintillating rainbow colors, and, you know, maybe a fairy queen comes materializing out of it or something like that, and you can take it from being scary to arousing a sense of wonder. You know, so you can basically just start looking at what is the opposite emotion and where can I go with that? And so that's another trick to creating that twist.
Very nice.
Okay, so you're going to get up through your first try-fail cycle. And, of course, it's called a try-fail cycle for a reason, because they're going to try something and they're going to fail. And it has to be a failure at some level. It may be really close, you know. It may look like they've succeeded, character has succeeded, but still something is lost, and your character doesn't succeed, usually because they've underestimated the nature of the problem or the size of the problem. And so we have to have the story has to go to the point where we get into a second try-fail cycle. Now, between these try-fail cycles, a couple of things can happen. First of all, the story, the problem can get bigger, and it gets bigger in one of two ways. Either the story involves more people, okay, the story is called broadening the story, or the story can deepen. Now, for example, let's say that you've got a detective who's looking at a murder investigation. He may have a victim. It's a 16-year-old girl. It's his first victim. And he goes and he exhausts all the clues looking for the killer. Can't come up with all the pieces to the puzzle, but suddenly there's another victim, okay, and a whole new family that's grieving and all that goes with that, and more pressure from the governor or the mayor or whatever. And so, you know, that's an example of a story broadening. And so when we watch murder mysteries, nowadays we almost always watch murder mysteries about serial killers simply because it's so much easier to plot the murder mystery that way. So broadening a story involving more people is one way to handle enlarging the tale. Another way to do it, of course, is to deepen the story. Deepening the story means that it has a more powerful influence upon the protagonists than was first anticipated. And so if we're dealing with our detective once again, and he gets into this, he will start seeing that in his murder investigation, you know, he may find that he can't sleep at night. He lies awake thinking. He might find that he's working for 16 hours a day, that he needs to, in order to get any sleep at all, he has to pretty much get drunk. His wife may threaten to leave him or may actually leave him. You've seen all these devices used before, you know. But that's the deepening part of the story. And we might discover that in his background that he had a sister who was killed when he was a child, that was murdered, and that led him to become a cop. And so, you know, this is dredging up a lot of old memories for him. And so we find that between each of the tri-fail cycles, the story has to either deepen or broaden. You know, there's an old saying, there's only three rules for writing the middle of your story, and that is escalate, escalate, escalate.
Uh-huh.
Okay? You got to make it tougher. You got to make it harder. So the next tri-fail cycle is once again a tri-fail cycle. In other words, your protagonist is going to put more effort into resolving the problem. And your first tri-fail cycle may take only 10% of your book, okay, 10% of your story. But your second tri-fail cycle very often is going to take quite a bit more effort, maybe 25% of your story. So if you've got a 400-page novel and you're going to take 25% of it, you know, then your second tri-fail cycle might take, you know, somewhere between 80 and 100 pages of the story. So your character has to spend time marshaling his resources, gathering his friends, gathering his nerve, trying to figure more out about who his antagonist is and what his antagonist's resources are. You know, he has to do a great deal of learning and growing in order to try again. But he has to fail again too, and the reason for that is really kind of simple. In real life, when we're confronted with things, if something happens to us, if something bad happens to you, you know, it's just a fluke, okay? If it happens again, then it's a coincidence. But if it happens a third time, a pattern's established. And we find that heroes are people who break patterns, okay? They come up with ways to stop bad things from happening to them repeatedly. So it requires three attempts. And if you don't believe me, just try reading a few hundred stories, a few thousand stories, and you will. You'll see it. Well, I get very often with Writers of the Future, I used to get perfectly good stories that were, you know, beautifully written, great characters, nice setting. The entire fate of the world was, you know, at risk, and the character would go out and try to resolve it, and bam, they'd do it on the first attempt.
Yay!
Like, well, that was easy. You know, it didn't really require much. And, you know, you just...
Why am I reading this again?
I couldn't put the stories through, you know, if that happened. They couldn't qualify to be finalists because there was just too little story there, you know. That's not much of a story. It's like saying, you know, yeah, I used to have a bully in my school, and, you know, he came up to me and asked me for my lunch money, and I beat the bejesus out of him, you know. That's not much of a story. I mean, you've got to get a little bit more in the telling and go through and talk about, you know, the crying, the sniveling to your mother, the punching bag she bought you for Christmas, and all of that to explain how you beat this bully up, you know. So there's a lot more to it.
When you have a conflict and something the hero is trying to accomplish, he tries once and he fails. On the second try-fail, if the conflict actually gets harder, you know, added elements, you know, maybe another murderer comes on the scene, is that the same thing as another try-fail cycle?
It is. He's still trying to resolve his problem, but the problem seems to be growing, you know, and is rapidly getting to the point where he doesn't have the resources to handle it, you know. It's
yeah.
sort of like it has to be a big problem. I mean, you know, Superman, you know, for him, walking across the street is not a big problem, you know, because he can walk across the street, even busy freeways. And if there's a semi-truck coming, he can just put his hand out and wreck it, you know. But that's not a problem. So you've got to have something that presents a real challenge to the person. Physically, intellectually, morally, emotionally, you know, it's all different ways that the person can be challenged. And you need to really show that this person is up against it. And so we get into the third try-fail cycle. And if you're writing a book, if you're writing a big, long story, you know, the third try-fail cycle may take, you know, half of the entire book.
Uh-huh.
Would be about right. You know, if it's a 400-page book, 200 pages is going to be devoted to building up that third try-fail cycle or that third attempt. Now, you know, in that third try-fail cycle, a lot of things can happen, but there's really only three possible endings to a story. And
uh-huh.
that is that, first of all, the first one is the happy ending, where the hero not only gets what he was hoping for, but gets it in spades, and sort of, in other words, you know, all of his dreams come true. So he finds the buried treasure. You know, he gets the girl, finds the buried treasure, captures the bank robbers, and clears his name, and ends up getting a huge reward for it, and you know, and everything in the world comes up sunny. Okay, the other uh-huh. ending is that he doesn't get what he wanted. Okay, he doesn't get the treasure. He doesn't get the girl. He ends up living his life on the run and that kind of thing. And the problem with that ending is it's not very satisfying. We as readers look at it and go, well, cow, there's nothing there, you know. Well, maybe there is things that you can gain. Sometimes you can gain wisdom. You can gain knowledge. It's sort of like I'll do better next time, that type of thing. And that can be you realize that the point of the story wasn't that he's going to get everything that he wanted. The point of the story is that he's going to grow as a person and change. And so that can still be an ending that works. But the third ending is the one that he has to pay a price to get what he wants most. Okay, so maybe he gets the treasure and he... Or maybe he loses the treasure, but he gets the girl, okay? And his name isn't cleared. He's going to live on the run, and he's broke and impoverished, but he's still got love, and he's, you know, he discovers that what he wanted most was that in the first place. If that's the case in your story, then that's typically the most powerful ending. The reason is that when you've got that, you know, just jaw-dropping happy ending where everything goes right, it doesn't really feel real. So typically the ending where a person has to pay a heavy price for something is the one that's going to work the best. I used to take stories in Writers of the Future, and I would give them to judges. You know, I'd pass them on to the judges. And with every group of stories, I tried to find one that had perfectly happy ending. And if I had two stories that were written equally well, one that had a perfectly happy ending and one that had a mixed ending, you know, the conflicted ending, the one where a price was paid, the one that had the mixed ending basically won every time. In my 10 years as a judge, you know, going through 40 different iterations of this, I never once had the happy ending story win over the story that was a little bit more complex. So the judges showed me basically that, hey, you just can't get away with it. You can get away with it in comedy. You know, if you've got a something like Rat Race or an episode of I Love Lucy or something, you could have a happy ending in comedy and have it work just fine because we aren't really expecting anything to be that realistic. So, you know, you have to be careful. But in a dramatic story, You just can't get away with that perfectly happy ending. You have to go for a complex ending.
Okay.
Very often there's going to be, once again, the ending will often have that reversal in it that I talked about earlier.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And the reversal is where your hero looks as if he's lost everything, and suddenly, through something that he's learned, an insight that he's gained, raw determination, stubbornness, his refusal to die, whatever, he's able to turn the tables on his victim, or on the villain, I should say. And so, for example, not the victim, yes. I was just thinking of in the movie Live Free and Die Hard. There's a great moment where Bruce Willis has, you know, gone and shot up all sorts of people, and looks like he's going to get to the villain. He does. The villain has his daughter there. He's forced to put his gun down, and the villain holds a gun on Bruce Willis while he orders his henchmen to. By the way, villains don't ever have girlfriends or friends. They're you know, basically victim. Yeah, they're henchmen, minions, whatever. Anyway, so he orders one of his minions to kill Bruce Willis's daughter, and Bruce Willis at that instant looks down and realizes that the way the guy is holding him with the angle of the pistol, that if he pulls the trigger, the bullet will go through the flesh of his shoulder and straight into the chest of the villain. So he just reaches up and pulls the trigger and shoots himself and the villain in one shot, and then takes the gun and shoots the shoots the minion, and the story's over. So that's a good example of a reversal, one that I thought that was really well handled.
Cool.
But you'll see them in comedies. You know, there might be six reversals. You know, they'll do something stupid where, you know, at the very end, the good guy gets his gun and points it at the villain and says, "Aha!" And then one of the villain's henchmen suddenly says, "Hey, look behind you, dude." And you realize that he's got a gun on him, and then the good guy's best friend, his sidekick, you know, says, "Ah, I've got you." And next thing you know, there's a big Mexican standoff with 20 guys and the police coming in, and you know, all that kind of stuff. You might get those kind of comic reversals, but typically one reversal is about the most that you can handle. Sometimes you can handle two reversals in the ending, but that's the story, part of the story that's really important. And last of all, we have the denouement, the ending of your story. It's not enough to tell the story and then just, you know, let everything lie where it will. You have to take a little bit of time and let the audience know that the story is over. And by that I mean, it's very popular in literary fiction to write stories that just sort of drop off into nowhere, okay, that have the endings clipped off because, you know, the writer wants the reader to be able to decide what they think happened. Or, you know, there's something, that kind of thing. And a good example of that, you know, comes with Ernest Hemingway's A Clean, Well-Lighted Place. Ernest Hemingway wrote a letter to his agent when he wrote that, and he said, "I've just written a story about an old man whose son is off in the war, and the old man gets a telegram telling him that his son has been killed, and then he goes down to a bar." And he gets drunk and goes home and hangs himself, okay? Except that in the story, A Clean, Well-Lighted Place, all that really happens is an old guy goes into a bar and gets drunk. We are basically left by the tone to try to figure out what's really going on. We're never told that he had a son who was killed in a war and he's just been notified. And we don't know that he goes home and hangs himself. But if you think about the tone at the end of the story, you go, "Oh yeah, something bad's going to happen. This guy's life, whatever life he has, is over." You know, that's really the tone of the story. So, you know, that's kind of a thing that is done in literary fiction, but it doesn't really work for most people. There's a lot of people who will go, "Yeah, I like that," or "No, I don't like that." But overall, you know, probably 70-80% of the audience is going to want to know what really happened at the end, okay? Which means that you need to have an ending. And, you know, if you've got a love story, that means the two lovers have got to get together. Either there's got to be an engagement ring or a wedding scene or something like that. If you've got a murder story, the murderer has to be apprehended or shot, or apprehended then shot, or then shot then apprehended, or something. You know, and it may even be so that you need to go so far as have the medical examiner, you know, sit there and look over the guy and say, he's dead, Jim. In other words, you just have to make sure that you clean up all the loose ends. Orson Scott Card once was talking to a young man when I happened to be standing nearby, and the guy was like, "How do you juggle all of your, or how do you handle all your conflicts?" You know, and you know, you've got so many of them, so many things going in a story. And Scott said, "You know, it's just like juggling. When you watch a really professional juggler, you know, he throws a ball up in the air, and it might go up way in the air, it might go 20 feet, or it might only go 3 feet, but your eye is focused on the ball that's in the air." He says, meanwhile, the juggler is passing balls to his throwing hand. He might have, he might be tossing them, you know, a short distance. He might be pulling them out of his pockets and handing them to himself or whatever, but he's got a throwing hand and a catching hand. And he's going to be making those little passes, but you don't really notice that. You only notice the balls that are in the air. Well, every conflict is a ball, and the way that you put it in the air is you show it to the reader. You know, you start talking about it. So if there's a major conflict that's coming up, your audience has to know that you've got that that conflict. And as long as that's, you know, up in the air, there's a certain amount of unease in the reader. You know, if you've got six balls in the air, the reader may be really fascinated. He's watching all of those balls. But as soon as all of those balls fall, as soon as they're all at rest, your story is done. Okay? And so, you know, if you go through and you let the balls get to rest too early and you just keep on writing, the reader's going to go, "Well, God, the story's over. Why am I reading?" And they'll close the book. If, on the other hand, you've got a conflict that's unresolved, then hey, there's something more going on here. Either the story was not written properly, or this is maybe the first book in a series. So, you know, if you've got your villain escaping at the very end and your characters are just happy to get off with their lives, then that's a good signal that this is the first book in a series. And so that's kind of the way that you handle it. You got to make sure that you resolve your conflicts. Very often, it actually requires a person who has some sort of specialized training or skills to go in and verify it. I mean, the whole "he's dead, Jim," you know, having a doctor examine the villain to let us know from an authority figure that he's dead. You know, that tells us the story's over. With the original Star Wars movie, when they ended the movie, it ended with the explosion of the Death Star. And they, you know, got to the point where the stars exploded and Luke Skywalker's flying off into the sunset and Darth Vader is spinning, you know, out of control and finally gets control of his vehicle and takes off in a different direction. And the viewers all sat there afterwards sort of stunned and said, "Well, is that it? You know, is that time to go home? Gosh, you know, that wasn't much of an ending."
Yeah.
So what they did was they Lucas went back and they reshot one final scene, the scene where they're getting medals pinned on them,
and
added a couple of minutes to it. But that was just their way of saying, "Okay, it's over. You know, the good guys won. The Death Star is destroyed, and now they're all part of the Rebel Alliance." And so then the story was over with a lot of clapping and cheering.
Cool.
And that ending worked a lot better. So you've got to make sure that you have an ending that's going to satisfy your readers and that ties up all of the loose ends and brings your story back to rest.
Cool.
Okay, that's just the basic parts of a story, okay? And I'd say that I've got my character, Well, I'm going to start with my setting, develop my setting, my characters, my conflicts, decide how I'm going to do that, go through my my inciting incident. Then I'm going to have two try-fail cycles. I'm going to have a try-possible-fail-or-succeed cycle. So, you know, that's going to give me my first, that gives me eight parts of a story, and then I'm going to go through my denouement, and I'll consider that my ninth part of a story.
Now, I am just at the end of the book that I am writing, and so I'm wondering, what are the pitfalls in writing the denouement that I should avoid?
Well, the first pitfall, and this is something that men do quite a bit, is that they end the story too abruptly, you know. They try to get to a nice emotional point, and I know that when I was writing, you know, back in the olden days, that I would tend to get to the end of a novel and have a good scene that would leave you crying. Okay, I'd say, okay, it's over. And, and my wife would get to it and say, what, only four pages of tears, you know? I want more of an ending. With my last novel, with In the Company of Angels, when my wife was reading it, I kept her in tears for the last 100 pages. And that was much more satisfying, you know. Just keep her going. And so I'd say that the main thing is don't end it too early, you know. Go ahead and give yourself plenty of time and just have a lot of fun with it. And especially look for the emotional payoff, you know, over and over and over again. If there's any way that you can figure out to wring a little bit more of an emotional payoff out of that story, then go ahead and do it. And that means that, you know, if you've got a young man who has just won the heart of a girl and you know that her parents have objected, you know, then you need to have a moment where the father and the mother, you know, talk to the boy and either, you know, accept him or you know, something has to happen. So there needs to be that confrontation. There needs to be the official proposal, maybe the wedding. There needs to be, you know, if you've got a murder investigation, you've got to find the guy. You may actually have to take him to court and have a final scene where he's convicted and taken off to jail or you know, taken to the execution chamber or something like that, you know. So you want to take your villain and really handle that. Sometimes it can be just little things that people leave undone, you know. I once read a story where a guy lost his car keys and it was really important because he needed a ride to get to a crime scene and so he ended up having to call his girlfriend to get a ride, you know. And when I got done with the story, I just had this really weird feeling, and I realized that he never did find his car keys, you know. There was one conflict left unresolved. So you need to resolve all of them. And that means that, you know, gosh, if you've got a cowboy, you know, he's been how his horse is going to do, he needs to have a moment where he checks out his horse at the end of the story and, you know, says, oh, yeah, he's limping a little bit, but, you know, he's not going to go lame forever and it's all going to be okay, you know, that type of thing. So don't end it too abruptly. And make sure, I think that most of the time you want to make sure that you have a price that's to be paid. And don't forget the power of creating emotional twists at the end, too, you know. You may have parents who are accepting. You don't want to have them come in and say, oh, you know, we really love you. You want to have them come in and, you know, the mother of the girl, if you've got a romance story, the mother of the girl who's been antagonistic the whole time, you know, she might have a hard time of it, you know. Keep her in tears, you know. Her fists are clenched and, you know, and she finally agrees that he can marry you know, this, that you're worthy to marry my daughter, you know, kind of thing. But you know, she can come in being angry. They can have a fight. They can have an argument. But, you know, eventually he should win. You know, he's it's got to be accepted. You know, it has to be closed down. We have to close down that conflict.
We can't leave them fighting.
Can't leave them fighting, yep. It has to be resolved. And so you need to make sure that you feel that the story is adequately resolved. Very often, you know, there are lessons that are learned through the through the course of a story. And so there might be points where you review some of those lessons. That's always a good thing to do, is, you know, what the character has learned from it. So, you know, okay. that's the biggest problem with the resolutions, is that too many people just sort of abandon the story too early.
Okay. Well, thank you. We try and get some time for questions if you've got a few minutes.
Sure.
But first I want to talk about some of the stuff that you've got going on. First of all, we've got the Superstars Writing Seminar on January 5th through the 15th. That city. Thank you. Brandon Sanderson, Eric Flint, and Sherilyn Kenyon are all going to be there. Who should go to that seminar, Dave?
Well, this is a seminar that is for people who are interested in writing, and new